Thank you.
I told you, it's going to be a good day. We go back to Patanjali. When you're inspired by some great purpose, now I want to keep in mind, I use that word great purpose, but that can mean anything. You don't have to be a Mozart or a Van Gogh or a Bill Russell or a Michael Jordan or anybody that has a lot of publicity. When you're inspired, when you're back in spirit, you will find that things start shifting for you. And as he said, dormant forces come alive. Your consciousness expands in every direction. And I think that Immaculee's story, and thank those of you for who've ordered the book. I'll see to it that it's shipped to you. And she'll sign them all. We'll deliver them to her home in New York. When I say that your consciousness expands in every direction, or when Patanjali said that, it's like you find a way to be inspired virtually any place, anywhere, at any time. Most people who, what I'm trying to teach people about this 10-rung ladder and being careful, like somebody came up to me and said, I read that book and it didn't work for me because I don't believe it. And I said to him, the gentleman, he was very serious and very nice, I said, if you have a desire up here and you read something and your attitude or your belief system, it's not an attitude problem, it's just your belief is that it isn't going to work or that you don't believe it, then, and if you understand that you become what you think about all day long, then you're going to attract not what it is that you have a desire for, but what it is that you are offering up to that desire. And what you're offering up to that desire is a vibration that doesn't match it. So when you are matching vibrationally, which means just with your thoughts and with your energy, you're now allowing the energy of what it is that you would like to attract to begin to come into your life. This is what it means when he says your consciousness expands in every direction. So you start finding yourself looking for moments to be in a state of gratitude. I start out every day 3:15 in the morning when I'm writing, and when I do that, the first thing that I do is I meditate just for a few moments in a prayer of thankfulness, of gratitude. Just like I started out my talk here today. I always start out with an expression of gratitude to let myself know that I'm looking for occasions to be in a state of awe and in a state of love and in a state of appreciation rather than in a state of being offended, because most people are looking for occasions to be offended. And they very seldom disappoint themselves. Rumi said, truly, sell your cleverness and purchase bewilderment. Purchase bewilderment. Just get yourself into a state where there is nothing that you can't feel grateful about. Find something to be grateful for and express it. Now, when you get into that place, this thing that you think about, like fatigue and writer's block, see, these are, Abraham says that all disease is nothing but resistance to God consciousness. It's just resistance, because we don't come from disease, we come from ease. And when we live from a perspective of looking for what's wrong, then we just keep attracting it, and you'll find it coming up. I have a radio show that I do every Monday on this hayhouseradio.com. You can find it somehow. I don't know how you find it. I don't even have a computer, but all I know is people call me from all over the world every Monday at 4:00. And it's almost everybody's question is the answer is almost always the same. This is what I want. It's not coming. And then I just talk to them for 2 minutes to find out, well, what do you think about what it is that you would like to expect, that you would like to have show up in your life, and what shows up, what they keep saying is, but it's not working. It doesn't show up. It's never worked before. I've seen other people happen, and it doesn't for me. And I said, here you have all of this up here, and you're offering this. And I think of Immaculate in that bathroom, having a knowing, somehow a knowing that she tapped into, that I've got to learn English. Because I've got to write a book in English, and I'm, what is the title? Left to Tell. I'm going to survive, and I'm going to tell it. I mean, don't you remember Viktor Frankl, and, when he was in the concentration camps? Man's Search for Meaning. I was so blessed. I was on a program with him in Vienna in 1978 for YPO. I was just fortuitous enough to happen to be sitting on the same stage. I didn't feel, that I belonged there, but there I was. And here was this man who had survived the concentration camps saying that his reason for living was he had to tell the story. And the idea is that when your consciousness expands in every direction, it means that what he's really saying is every direction means there is no direction. There's no front and back. There's no forward. There's no in oneness, there's just oneness. So there's not tomorrow and yesterday. That only exists in our conscious minds, that we've invented this thing called yesterday and tomorrow. But when you leave this world, the physical world that you're in, and meld those dichotomies, as it says in the Bhagavad Gita, when you merge those opposites, you'll discover that tomorrow and yesterday are all one. So here is somebody who's living at that level of consciousness saying, I've got to learn English, knowing that I'm going to be lecturing in it, I'm going to be writing about it, I'm going to be talking about it in English, and my children are going, her children think that she talks funny, because they go to an American school. And it's like, when you have that, and it's not just something that gets you through a genocide, because when Immaculate writes to me all the time, we speak almost every day, and when she writes to me, she told me, and I'm using this in the introduction to her book, or in the foreword to her book, when she got her job at the United Nations, she went to the United Nations and found the department that she was interviewing for, and put her name in the directory at the United Nations and copied it and took it home, and she gave herself a telephone extension. Is that true? Isn't it? It's true. And was actually feeling bad for the other person who was also applying for the same job, because she knew that she already had it because she had her own telephone directory and her own line. And was apologizing to the other person who couldn't get it. Do you understand that when your consciousness expands in every direction, you can find inspiration everywhere and anytime? And when I close out a little while from now, I'll be telling you a story that totally bowled me over. I mean, it was the signature experience of my life. And some of you who've read, you'll see it when you believe it, and how I found my father, who was buried in Biloxi, but I don't think he is anymore. Really, he was buried 20 yards from the ocean there, and he's in here now. I really feel his presence. I feel his presence with me all the time. This is a man who walked out on me, who was a man that left me when I was just an infant and abandoned my mother and was probably the most important person in my life. Truly, the man who converted me. It was 10 years after he was dead, from a life of drinking, a life of not writing the way I wanted to write, not having the right people in my life, and so on. And it was an act of forgiveness at his grave in 1974. Totally turned my life around. Totally turned around. Wrote Erroneous Zones in 10 days after that. Just like that. Just flew out of me, and everything has since. And it was all that act of, I don't call it even forgiveness. It's an act of and I don't, and I even, I've told him, said this to Immaculate. It's an act of converting. I was having lunch with Ram Dass on Maui. And some of you know that I'm working to raise money for this man also. And if you want to go and find out what I'm doing about that, go on my website, WayneDyer.com, and there's a letter in there about why I'm working with Ram Dass to try to buy him a home because of all the things that he's done for everybody else. And all of his writing, he never took a penny from his royalties, never took any money for speaking fees. donated at all his whole life. He's had a stroke, and I'm going to be on stage with him soon, walking. I'm going to have him. I know that he's going to be walking. I did a benefit for him May 19th in Maui. But I was having lunch with Ram Dass, and he's paralyzed now, and his hand is down here, and half of his body is is in paralysis. But it's changing, it's shifting. I got him on glyconutrients, I got him swimming. We go swimming every Monday in the ocean. At any rate, I was talking about this thing with my father, and he said, he reached over, and he sort of in his halting voice said, Dwayne, he said, I really have a problem with that word forgiveness. And I said, what do you mean? He said, because who are you to be forgiving anybody? You know. And then I said, yeah. I said, The Course in Miracles says, in order to forgive, you must have blamed. He said, what sounds to me like what you did is you just changed hatred into love. That's all. That's really all forgiveness is. You know, as Mark Twain said, forgiveness is the fragrance that the violet sheds on the heel that has crushed it. You know, it's just, you just send love where you used to send hate. That's all you have to do. It's like, we're not in the business of forgiving other people. That's not our job. Our job is just to love, just to be in that state of love. So when your consciousness expands in every direction, you can find it. So I was talking about Ram Dass, so let me just share one of the most, I mean, you'll know in a moment why I love Ram Dass so much. He was so inspirational isn't the right word. He was instrumental in teaching me how to be a speaker and how to come into a room from the back and feel the love and be with everyone and see yourself as connected to everyone and not see yourself as better than anyone or above anyone and see that everyone that you meet and are with has just as much to teach you as you have to teach them and to be in that loving kind of spirit. That's how I live, that's how I write, that's how I speak. I don't want to be admitted, I don't want to have a big fancy anything for me. When I come in, I want to come in from behind and just want to talk to the people and be and feel the love. And he taught me that back in the 60s when I was in my 20s. Two friends of his, Steve and Anita, were very strong devotees of Ram Dass. And their daughter, Rachel, was murdered and raped, and her body was thrown. It was really in a horrible, horrifying way. And they wrote to him and asked how they could survive this. How can we just find love in this kind of thing? Their only daughter, their only child, murdered, raped, brutalized. This is what Ram Dass wrote to Steve and Anita, and you'll know why I'm doing what I'm doing for Ram Dass these days. Dear Steve and Anita, and this is about your consciousness expanding in every direction, being able to find inspiration any place, anywhere. Rachel finished her work on Earth and left the stage in a manner that leaves those of us left behind with a cry of agony in our hearts, as the fragile thread of our faith is dealt with so violently. Is anyone strong enough to stay conscious through such teachings as you are receiving? Probably very few. And even they would only have a whisper of equanimity and peace amidst the screaming trumpets of their rage, grief, horror, and desolation. I can't assuage your pain with any words, nor should I. For your pain is Rachel's legacy to you. Not that she or I would inflict such pain by choice, but there it is. And it must burn its purifying way to completion. For something in you dies when you bear the unbearable. And it is only in that dark night of the soul that you are prepared to see as God sees and to love as God loves. Now is the time to let your grief find expression. No false strength. Now is the time to sit quietly and speak to Rachel and thank her for being with you these few years and encourage her to go on with whatever her work is, knowing that you will grow in compassion and wisdom from this experience. In my heart, I know that you and she will meet again and again. and recognize the many ways in which you have known each other. And when you meet, you will know, in a flash, what now it is not given to you to know, why this had to happen. Our rational minds can never understand what has happened, but our hearts, if we can keep them open to God, will find their own intuitive way. Rachel came through you to do her work on earth, which includes her manner of death. Now her soul is free, and the love that you can share with her is invulnerable to the winds of changing time and space. In that deep love, please include me. Ram Dass. I don't know how writing gets any better than that. And that's why I ask you to look on my website and see the letters and what I've asked people to do for that man, who today is living a challenge that I think by Thanksgiving we'll be walking across the stage together. I've seen it, and I know it will be. So your consciousness expands in every direction, and that means that things like fatigue, which used to be something that concerned you, no longer are there. Jet lag doesn't exist, because jet lag and fatigue and writer's block and the kinds of things that you believe are what are keeping you from what you would like to have are not any longer a part of your consciousness, because you desire it. And it's in harmony with God, and it's on its way, and there's nothing for you to fuss about. And so what are you looking for? Evidence of it being on its way. And you start seeing the evidence of it being on its way everywhere. Aren't you doing that with this thing, with this Hurricane Katrina? Aren't you doing that now? I mean, when you turn on the TV, do you want to see more people saying about what we should have done and what we could have done and how terrible it was and how the president was incompetent and how this didn't work and they should have done that? Do you want to see any more of that? Does that help anything? Doesn't it feel good when you say, wow, we're rebuilding the city, they're pumping the water out, we're going to, you know, people are joining together, there's love here, we're going to make that. That's where you have to be in your life. Because when you're looking for what it is that you intend to create and what you intend to manifest, you become the conduit. You become the energy that is the thing that you think is missing in your life. Because fully functioning people never put their, I shouldn't say, fully functioning. People who live at God consciousness only put their attention on what they intend to manifest by reconnecting themselves back to God. That's it. I mean, we can go home. That's it. That's the name of the game. It's like thinking like God. It's being like God. That's what Einstein said. I mean, the greatest mind of the 20th century. He said, all I want to do is learn to think like God thinks. All the rest are just details of entertainment. They're just details for our entertainment, that's all. How does God think? And how God thinks is how any of us can think at any time. Dormant forces come alive means that the right people start showing up, that the events that you thought were impossible begin to be there. And instead of you saying, it's not going to happen, it won't work out, the right people aren't going to be there, every little clue, it's like you're looking for, there it is. Oh, that simple little thing. Because what happens is that spirit doesn't speak to you, doesn't write out something and hand it to you on a computer and say, okay, here I am. Spirit speaks to you in alignments, in alignments. When things start aligning, when you start have, this is what Jung spent a great deal of his time writing about with synchronicity and synchrodestiny, the idea that when you start thinking about something and putting your attention on it and knowing that it's going to show up and are obstinate about it. I call it being a scurvy elephant. Many of you have heard me use the term. Because when I was a little boy living in a foster home, I came home and I asked the lady, what's a scurvy elephant? She said, where'd you hear that? I said, I heard Mrs. Poole telling the principal outside the classroom that Wayne Dyer was in her classroom and he was a scurvy elephant. So she got on the phone and called, and the principal said, oh, that's Wayne. He gets everything mixed up. She didn't say he was a scurvy elephant in her classroom. She said he was a disturbing element in her classroom. And you have to be a disturbing element. You have to absolutely know If there's something that you love, there's something that you want that doesn't exist yet, it just simply doesn't exist yet enough yet because you haven't looked enough hard enough for it and haven't believed enough that it's coming, that it's on its way. And when you offer up to it, probably won't happen. Hasn't happened before. I don't believe in that stuff. That's not going to work. As soon as you offer that up to it, you become what you think about. As you, the man thinketh, so is he, and you start attracting that. People who live at God realization, Hawkins said that anybody who calibrates above 600, anybody who calibrates above 600, illness cannot survive in their presence. Above 600. Mother Teresa was a 600. Jesus was 1,000. Even death couldn't stand up to Jesus. Literally. The dead would rise. Because at that level of awareness, when you are vibrating to what I said earlier, when you're steadfast in your abstention of thoughts of harm directed toward yourself and others, all living creatures, animals become domesticated. They're not afraid of you. Babies, you know that they're in the presence of something divine. Birds, like St. Francis, who was a 900, just come and he preaches to them. Wild animals become tame in their presence. Because hatred and killing and so on are an impossibility. Dormant forces come alive. And you know what that's the result of? Here's the four things you got so far. You're inspired, some great purpose, some extraordinary purpose. Your thoughts break their binds. Your mind transcends limitations. Your consciousness expands in every direction, meaning there is no direction. It comes from everywhere. And dormant forces come alive. And then you discover yourself to be a greater person by far than you ever dreamed yourself to be. You start living in a different world. Castaneda said you have to learn how to do a somersault into the unimaginable, into the impeccable. It's like you just do this somersault. There's a tribe in Africa, in the northern part of South Africa, that Peace Pilgrim wrote about. Do you know who Peace Pilgrim was, most people? How many know? Peace Pilgrim? Few. She was a woman in her 60s and 70s and 80s, late 70s, who walked all across America and did nothing but, no one knew her name, did nothing but talk about peace. She just promoted it wherever she went. She got people would follow after her, the TV cameras would follow her, and she was just this sweet, divine little old lady who just talked peace wherever she went. And in her journals, she tells this story, and I brought it with me to share with you. Because this is what happens when you discover yourself to be in a totally new world. In the Bamemba tribe, about 1,000 people up near Zaire, when a person acts irresponsibly or unjustly, he or she is placed in the center of the village, alone and unfettered. Okay, so here you got a troublemaker. Someone who's disobeying the rules, someone who's a pain in the ass, someone who's a drug addict, someone who's, whatever it is, you've all got one in your family, you know. Or you are the one in the family. Well, you have been, right? I have been, so I know. So in the Bamemba tribe, this person acts irresponsibly. This person is placed in the center of the village, alone and unfettered. All work ceases. The entire village gathers around the accused individual, then each person of every age begins to talk out loud to the accused person. And this goes on for 2 days. One at a time, each person tells all the good things the one in the center ever did in his or her lifetime. Every incident, every experience that can be recalled with any detail and accuracy is recounted. All positive attributes, all good deeds, all strengths, all acts of kindness are recited carefully and at length. No one is permitted to fabricate, to exaggerate, or to be facetious about the accomplishments or positive aspects of the accused person. The tribal ceremony lasts for several days, not ceasing until everyone is drained of every positive comment that can be mustered. At the end, the tribal circle is broken, a joyous celebration takes place, and the person is symbolically welcomed back into the tribe. Necessity for such ceremonies occurs about once every 5 years in the tribe. Now, just let that sink in for a minute. And think about the troublemakers. And think about the people in your life that have caused so much trouble and that you're in pain about. And I can honestly stand up here in front of two of my daughters and tell you the truth, because the daughter that I'm speaking about has given me permission to do so. When she got herself involved in drugs and alcohol and into... see, when you're a scurvy elephant yourself, you get paid back, like... So there's a karmic principle involved here that I don't want to go too deeply into, but it's... And this was a period of several years in which there was tremendous disruption in the family, in my health, in my wife's health and happiness, and all of the other brothers and sisters and so on. And it would go on, and she wouldn't come home. And when she did come home, she would be angry. And when she got angry, then she would just get violent. And there was all of this kind of stuff going on. And I have 8 children, and she was the one that consistently did these kinds of things over and over and over again. And we tried, whatever. So I, one day, in my great wisdom, I called a family meeting, got all the family members together, we all gathered around, and everybody proceeded to tell her how hard it was to live with her and how much pain she was causing all of us. And from the littlest ones to the oldest one, we all went through this whole thing. And when it was over, she went out and got stoned, which is what I would want to do too. Because who wouldn't want to, you know, go out and escape that when everybody just tells you what a crappy person you are? And now you've had it reinforced even by little ones and big ones and so on. And since then, I have, this was a while back, I've learned from the Bamemba people, from Peace Pilgrim, from whatever it is. And if I could redo that, I would put her in the center of a circle and I would do what they do. And that's why I'm telling you to do it, whoever that is. That is, how could a person help but become more elevated if they were totally surrounded by how wonderful they were and how great they were and how positive they were? Like when you were just a little girl and you would come home, you would make everybody laugh because you called a cookie a dadu, and you, when you asked for dadus, and which is true, and it's like, and all the fun things and all the, you know, and how much we remember about you, how much we loved you, and how much you made us all laugh, and the time when we were in Hawaii and you went out and bought mom a gift and you brought it home, and you were always doing that for strangers, and you're just on and on and on. I mean, if you'd imagine how the person would, why don't we do that? Why do we use shame? Why do we use anger? Why do we use... It's like if we would do more of this in the world, and don't you understand it extends politically, it extends to why we have war. I mean, you can't have a Christian war and not be Christ-like. I mean, what did Jesus say about your enemies? Pray for those who persecute you. How much time have we spent praying for the insurgents, the people that were out there trying to kill every day, and calling ourselves, you know, Christians or whatever? Why aren't we finding out why we're hated and sitting down with people and saying, hey, let's find out. Even if, you know, why not? And if there's so much of that, maybe we can come to a place instead of, you know, it's like trying to get rid of your dandelions through violence. You remember dandelions? Boy, I remember dandelions. I grew up in Michigan, and they come up and they're yellow, and then they got those fuzz balls, you know, all over them, those little fuzzy things. Imagine trying to get rid of your dandelions that you want in your lawn by getting a big baseball bat and just whacking the hell out of them, just whacking them, and all you do is what? You just spread more of them, and before you know it, you got, as Martin Luther King Jr. said, you can't. The only way that you can convert an enemy to a friend is through love. You can't do it through hatred. You can't do it through killing. You just create new generations of people who are going to hate you. We have to learn how to do that thing that I'm speaking about here, is go to spirit. Go within and know that we are all connected. Why are we training people to go over there and kill people that if we ever sat down with them, they'd have a pizza with us? And they would love us, wouldn't they? I don't know. It just seems so simple to me. It seems so easy. We find ourselves in a new and a great and a wonderful world when you move into spirit. And this business of moving into spirit is so profound. I want to close out this section of it with a story. And it's, I can't wait for you to see the book, the inspiration book. I normally have it on a screen, but we didn't have the, what are they, LPEGs, JPEGs, GPEG? JPEGs, yeah. So we couldn't, I don't know why we couldn't do that, but. So March, or April the 23rd, I finished writing Inspiration. 17th chapter, all I knew is I had the 18th chapter to finish. I knew it was going to be 18 chapters before I started, like Immaculee knew she had to learn English. Because 18 is the number. It's just 1-8. I mean, one infinity, one infinite power. 18, that's what it is. It's the number of chapters in the Bhagavad Gita. It's the number of visions that Bernadette saw in Lourdes. It's the number of holes on a golf course. I mean, it's a And I just knew that 18 has always been, and is considered in the Jewish faith, I think it's called Chai? Say it. Chai. Yeah, you have to know. And it means sweet fullness of light. I like that, of life. Anyway, you're going to go to hell for being in this church, too. You're supposed to be in a synagogue. So chapter 17 was finished, and I wrote in this in the 17th chapter this story. It's the story of my friend Jack Boland. Now I don't know how many know who Jack Boland was. Few. He was a great minister in Detroit, Unity minister of a minister just like this. He was like a brother to me. We were very close. When I wrote Erroneous Zones, he was giving talks at a high school, Regina High School on the east side of Detroit, in a classroom. And I wrote Erroneous Zones, and he called me up, and I didn't know who he was, and he asked me if he could create some tapes based upon that book at this little church gathering that he was doing back in the 70s. And I became very, very close to him. And Jack and I used to always talk about, Jack died about 11 years ago. And he used to always talk to me about butterflies, about monarch butterflies. And we used to talk about this language of spirit, and it's become very clear to me. I wonder how many of you have ever had a wild bird, not a little parakeet, but a wild bird, brush against you or touch you or land on you, a wild bird. Now, how many have ever had that experience? Okay, if I ask each of you that story, you have to know that when something like that happens, when a bird that has in its DNA, it's programmed to avoid human contact, that you have just had an alignment experience. And it happens with birds particularly, it happens with butterflies, it happens with any animals that have this program away, you know, to stay away from you when that seems to get violated, that this is an alignment, and that spirit speaks to us in these kinds of alignments. When that happens, if a wild bird ever brushes against you, ask yourself what you were thinking, and know that you're getting an alignment message of one kind or another. Alignments also are when you're thinking about someone and that person shows up, you're thinking about an idea, and three or four times in the same day, you see it in a newspaper, somebody sitting next to you talks about it, you turn on the television, they're talking about it, then the telephone rings and somebody calls and asks you if you'll get it for them, if it's a book, or whatever it might be. Or you're thinking about your sister and you haven't seen her in 7 years and she calls you on the telephone and that. These things are alignments, okay? And I wrote a lot about that, the language of spirit. And I was writing about that. Now, Jack had this thing about monarch butterflies. And monarch butterflies are really intriguing creatures because they come out of a cocoon on a branch in Brazil, in a tree. in Brazil, okay? And they haven't got a brain. They've got a little pinprick for a brain. It's like just if you took a pin and pricked them, that's how big their brain is, all right? And they're made out of tissue paper, basically toilet tissue. That's what they are. They're just like these fragile little creatures. And Jack used to go crazy when we would talk about these things with me and say, he said, imagine this thing with no brain and these little tissue paper wings comes out of a cocoon in Brazil and flies to Nova Scotia. To Nova Scotia, that's 4,000 miles. It goes, and it just spends the summer in Nova Scotia for whatever reason looking for salmon. I don't know what he's doing up there, all right? And makes a U-turn and turns around and flies all the way back to Brazil to the same tree, to the same branch of the same tree. It has no brain, it's tissue paper, and it creates another cocoon and starts the whole thing all over again. Now, my brain is supposed to be pretty big. I leave my keys in my room. I walk out of the room. I come back. I can't find my keys. I got a brain this big. And this thing can find a branch on a tree that it started. Okay, so they're like, just so you get the point, these are amazing little spiritual creatures. And butterflies are really big in the spirit world if you start studying the alignment of them. And when one approaches you or touches you or stays with you, it's alignment. It's spirit aligning in some way. Be conscious of alignment. Even numbers, like I ask you about what time you wake up and so on, when the same numbers keep showing up over and over and over again, just be conscious of that. It's like, it's easy to say, oh, that has no meaning, oh, that's ridiculous, again, blah, blah. Just let go. Let go of all of that resistance and get yourself up here to a number 10. This is a way that spirit is saying, it's on its way. It's on its way. What you're looking for is on its way. Here's a sign. It's too much of a coincidence that the same thing keeps happening over and over again, and you sit down and a stranger mentions it. And you know, I mean, I've got 1,000 examples like that, but you know what I'm speaking about. You're nodding. I know you know. So I finish writing that whole thing that I've just told you about spirit and alignment. And when I was with Jack up at Deepak's place when he was in Massachusetts, we went there because he had cancer in his back, and we went on a healing expedition, the two of us, for a week. I insisted that he come with me, and he was going to do the Panchakarma and do all of the different treatments and so on. But his cancer was pretty far gone. We talked about these monarchs, and when we were out there, I found a dead monarch, perfect condition, and I had it taken to one of these places that put it into like a paperweight, and I gave it to him as a gift. And he loved that gift, and he kept it for the last year or so of his life. And when he died, his wife, Karen, sent it back to me with a letter telling me how much he loved it and appreciated it. I went to Jack's funeral. Jack conducted his own funeral. He did. He knew he was leaving within weeks, and so he invited all of the close people in his life to his church in Detroit, which is one of the largest Unity churches in the world right now. And we wheeled out in a wheelchair and told the whole story at any rate. So I finish, I call my editor, her name is Joanna, she lives in Bainbridge Island, and out in Washington, and I read her, I always, when I finish a chapter, I always read it to her to get a sense of how does it sound, and told her the whole story. Then I called my publisher, my friend Reed, out in Carlsbad, California, at Hay House, and I read it to him, and I was just, you know, when you complete something, I started it, I had seen the book every day, that puja table that I talked about, it was like this table. I would get up in the morning, go out, do my meditation, run, all of those kind of things, come back, and it would pull me toward it. And I would sit down and I'd pick up one of the 1,000 or so books that I have all spread around there. The whole place is just organized around this writing thing. And the energy would always pull me. And now, I had started it December the 6th, and it was April 23rd, and I'd written every day, all by hand, all with my hand on my heart, just purple pen through the page, through my heart, onto the page, just sending it off to be done. I mean, it's too exquisite. I'm getting that kundalini, that warm shower, just thinking about it, because I'm going to be back, because I'm working on a book of poetry now. one of the things I was always told is I can't write poetry, so scurvy elephants. You know. And I'm starting to do some painting, and I'm starting yoga on October the 1st. I'm going to do yoga for 40 days and 40 nights and fast and so on. It's kinds of, you know, just wonderful, great challenges that I love to do. So I had completed it. I was ecstatic, and I went for a walk. And I walked from, I live at a place called the Kanapali Ali'i over in Kanapali Beach. And I came out and I walked to the right along the ocean to the Sheridan, which is a place called Black Rock, all the way down. It's about half a mile or so, maybe three quarters of a mile. And it's about 1 o'clock in the afternoon. And all of a sudden, a monarch butterfly flying around, and you see them there fairly often, but I've never seen one do this, and it did like a U-turn kind of thing, and it stopped right in front of me on the grass. And I looked at it and thought, and I got that feeling, you know, and I went over and said, what are you doing here? And I went to pick it up, and it looked at me like, what's the matter with you? I'm a butterfly, you know, I don't talk to people, you know, and it flew away. And it flew about 40 yards. It made a U-turn, and it came back, and it landed right here on my finger, okay? So now I got a monarch butterfly on my finger, and I have just written about that whole story that I just told you, just read it, and I'm like freaked out, okay? Really? So I thought, oh, well, you know, it's Jack. So I'm calling him Jack, or Papillon. I'm going back and forth. And so I thought, oh, well, that was a nice thing. So it stays with me. So I put my other finger up, and it goes on the other finger. And it won't leave. So this thing has just stuck with me. So I had my cell phone in my pocket. I reached in, and I called Joanna, and I told her, there's a monarch butterfly in my hand. She said, but you just read that. I said, yes. She said, just go meditate and just be at peace with it. It's an alignment. You just wrote a whole chapter, the 17th chapter, on the language of spirit, right? So I went back and I sat down on the grass right in front of Black Rock, and I sat there for 30 minutes meditating with my eyes open, talking to this butterfly. Now I brought it up close to my face, and the butterfly was, okay, I told you when it gets weird, I'm gonna tell you. The butterfly was trying to talk to me. Its mouth was making butterfly, stop laughing over there. That's and its wings were doing this, like this, back and forth, back and forth, back and forth. So it's now 1:30, all right? It's 30 minutes. This frigging butterfly has been with me for 30 minutes, okay? So I call my publisher, I call Reed, and I tell him, I said, you're not going to believe this. He said, get a picture. Right away, thinking, you know, this is great. He said, we've been thinking about what the cover of the book would be. Wouldn't it be great if you could have a picture of yourself, it's a book on inspiration, looking at this butterfly. I said, what do you mean, get a picture? That requires a camera, you know, and I don't have a camera in my phone. I don't even hardly know how to use my phone, let alone a camera with a phone. He said, go back to your apartment. I said, it's three quarters of a mile. This thing's not going to stay with me. He said, do it, do it, do it. He was laughing. So I took off, and I started walking back. Now, the winds coming off of Kanapali Beach are so strong that they're blowing this butterfly, and its wings are doing this. You know, it's like all the way over to the side. It can't even... It can't hardly balance itself. It's almost like blowing this thing away, but it won't leave. It just won't leave. All right? So I get about halfway back to where I live, and there's a little girl who's about 4 years old, and she's on the pathway, and she's sobbing and sobbing and crying and just so distressed. She's got tears coming down her face, and she got the wrong color Slurpee. This is her crisis. I thought of Immaculate, you know, in the bathroom for 91 days, you know, what you would do for a Slurpee, right? So hers was yellow instead of purple or something, and she was just And I looked at her, and I just tapped her on her shoulder. I said, honey, I said, would you like to talk to my pet butterfly? I did. And she turned from this sad, depressed, oh, just horrified little thing whose Slurpee color was wrong, into the most bliss. Oh, is that yours? What's his name? I said, Jack. And can I hold him? I said, no, it's with me. It's now 2 o'clock, okay? It's been an hour. This butterfly has not left. He's gone from one hand to the other, and he was able to turn this little four-year-old's life into this most blissful moment. I thought, this is a magical, something is going on here, all right? So I get all the way back to the place that I write at, and which takes about another half an hour, and I'm walking with my butterfly talking. I walk up the stairs, I walk out, I go out onto the lanai, I take the manuscript that I had written by hand, showing the butterfly what I had written about it by hand, this purple ink. I did, I'm telling you. It was a bizarre moment, it really was. So I put the butterfly and I set it down. I said, look, I don't know, what do you eat? I mean, I don't know what to do for you, you know. Do I have a leash? I mean, am I stuck with this butterfly for the rest of my life? I don't know what, anyway. I go in and I take a shower. I call Reed and I call downstairs and there's a girl named Cindy, she's downstairs. I said, they have a place, it's about 2 blocks from here where they sell these portable disposable cameras. I said, would you run in and get one? She said, I can't leave here. I said, Cindy, there's $100 in it if you're here in 5 minutes. She was there in about 2 minutes, okay? Inspiration. So she came up and she took 29 pictures of me with the butterfly looking here, looking down, with its wings out, doing, you know, posing, doing this. It was like, really? So now I got evidence, you know, and I've got the butterfly. I go in and I take a shower. It's now 3:30 in the afternoon. This butterfly's been with me for 2.5 hours. This is church, I'm telling you, I'm not exaggerating one bit here. I go back out after taking a shower. I'm going to now figure out what I'm going to do with my butterfly. And I put my finger down, and it looked up at me, and it looked like it looked the first time when it landed about 2 feet away from me at 1 o'clock. Like, are you crazy? I'm a butterfly. I don't want anything to do with you. And it circled around me, took off to let me know that it wasn't wounded, because all this time I kept thinking, well, maybe it's a wounded butterfly. Soared up into the sky, made a U-turn like that, made a circular turn like, and took off. And that was my butterfly story. Now, we have... Now, this is like when you know something. You know, there's nobody on this planet who could ever convince me that there wasn't something, some kind of an alignment with spirit operating at this moment that was taking place, had to be, for me, as far as I was concerned. So when they took the pictures, they came back, because pictures certainly weren't good enough to be on the cover of a book and all of that, but I insisted at the point of the threat of death to the art director that you have to use that butterfly. So that very butterfly I'm holding it and looking at, they took it off a computer somehow and they put that very butterfly on there, and it's a part of that. You'll see it when you see it. Usually I show that, they've got it all done up. And that, again, won't be out until March. At the same time, Immaculee's book is out, and it'll be on the PBS as well as one of the items. So that the language of spirit is one that speaks to us in ways like that. And since that time, I have tried to get any monarch just to even get close. I've never been able to get one to even touch me, to even come close. Okay, don't leave, because the best part's coming, okay? We're going to be done in about 10 minutes, I promise. So what I have been doing up here since 1 o'clock is going through these things that Patanjali said. Let me close it out with that. When you're inspired by some great purpose, meaning when you move back into spirit, all of your thoughts break their bonds, your mind transcends limitations, there's nothing that becomes impossible, your consciousness expands in every direction, that is, there is no direction forward, backward, up, down, it's all the same. and you find yourself in a new and a great and a wonderful world. You're in a world that you were not in before. Dormant forces, faculties, and talents come alive. That is, the universe starts conspiring with you, and you discover yourself to be a greater person by far than you ever dreamed yourself to be. That's what you get for inspiration. And if you want to know what I meant about speaking to spirit, how do you speak? How do you pray? How do you communicate with God? Three things. One, God cannot be anything other than what God is. Just like you cannot be anything other than what you are, and a frog cannot be anything other than what a frog is, God cannot be anything other than what God is. Now, God is what? Perfect abundance, well-being, kindness, love. Out of the course, I jotted down these words. Because your idea, now if you come to God with an idea that is not of God, all right, which is shortages, which is lacks, which is disease, which is heal me please, which is send me more money, which is send me the right person, if you come to God with thoughts like that, because your idea is not of God, God does not respond to it. To respond to it would give it reality. If God were to respond to anything other than perfect oneness, there would no longer be perfect oneness. Page 123 of the Course. If God were to respond to anything other than perfect oneness couldn't exist. So now you're sick and you want to be healed. Now you're poor and you want to attract abundance into your life. Now you're in a relationship or you don't have the right person, you'd like to attract the right person, whatever it might be. What do? You do what St. Francis did. When St. Francis didn't have peace in his heart and in his life, wherever he went, he found himself being obsessed with other people's problems. He was always being encouraged to heal this one and heal that one. Wherever he would go, he had no peace. He didn't say, God, I don't have any peace. Will you please bring me some peace? Because that which is perfect peace cannot respond to that which isn't peace. It can't do that. So what did St. Francis do in his prayer? This is what you have to do. He said, make me an instrument of thy peace. In other words, if you're sick and you'd like to be healed, don't look to God to heal you of something that it can't recognize in the first place. Instead say, make me an instrument of thy well-being. In other words, let me summon from this source of perfect wellness, let me remember to attract that back into my life. Just keep yourself focused on, it's almost like a ball out there with a magnet. I want to attract this into my life. And if you heard Immaculee's story, it's exactly what she was doing when she was in that bathroom for 91 days. Let me be like you are. And when you weren't like God was in your mind, you lived in total fear. And when you did change that, and we've talked about this many times, the fear went away. It was almost like a knowing. And she put in front of her a barrier. It's almost like Patanjali discusses this in his 37th sutra in How to Know God. This is stuff that I read, okay? I know it's weird, but I do. And that you can make yourself invisible. You can literally make yourself invisible. If you see someone coming at you that you don't want to see you, you don't want to know if you go, especially if you're going through customs, this is really great, but... Oops, sorry about that. If you see some, and you don't want to be seen, you literally have the power to be able to shrink yourself to a place where you can literally walk right through someone and not have them see you. I know it sounds like it's not a possibility, but there's nothing could ever explain how 200 people searching a little house could miss them 9 different occasions, 200 to 300 people searching with machetes, could miss them. 7, 8 people, one a child, 7 years, what, she was, the youngest was 7? 7, and a 13-year-old as well, right? So, when you pray, don't expect God to be anything other than what God is, 1. 2, It's not about learning new things, it's about remembering. The memory of God comes to the quiet mind. It cannot come where there is conflict. Now think about that. Why is it that God can't come where there is conflict? God doesn't enter conflicts. If you're in a conflict with the person that you love, if you're in a conflict with in a war or whatever, you can't get God there. Why? Because conflict requires what? Two-ness, doesn't it? It requires one and another. But God is oneness, is perfect oneness. The memory of God comes to the quiet mind. It cannot come where there is conflict. A mind at war with itself, that is, that's always in conflict, remembers not eternal gentleness. What you remember is who you are. You must be as God created you. Therefore, be done with this madness and return instead to the quiet memory of God. Just remember. Don't try to learn anything. Don't try to memorize what I've said here. Just remember who you are and where you came from. And finally, God knows. God doesn't need any reminder from you about what you should be. And you don't have to do it through going to church, and you don't have to do it through reading a particular book or paying certain dues or indulgences and so on. The way that you show your love for God is not by any of the ways that we have invented through our ego development. The way you show your love for God is by loving each other. That's the way you do it. You are love. You came from love. If you came from love and you want to be able to be like what you came from, that is to heal and to attract into your life abundance, if you want to have the power of your source, then you have to be like your source. So you have to be love in order to be able to perform these miracles that I've been speaking about. Those are the ways that you speak to God. Okay, it's late. I want to make a beautiful closing. And the most beautiful thing in this room, well, not the most beautiful, I got two daughters here, I'm in big trouble already. I was just taking notes on that, right? As I'm going to have Sky close it for us. By the way, I brought this to read to you, so I should. Why, of course the people don't want war. But after all, it's the leaders of the country who determine the policy, and it's always a simple matter to drag the people along, whether it's a democracy or a fascist dictatorship or a parliament or a communist dictatorship. Voice or no voice, the people can always be brought to the bidding of the leaders. This is easy. All you have to do is tell them that they're being attacked and denounce the pacifists for lack of patriotism and exposing the country to danger. It works the same way in any country. Oh, that was Hermann Göring, quoted in Nuremberg. That was Hitler's minister of propaganda. Yeah. We can make anybody believe that being for peace makes you unpatriotic. Anybody can convince anybody of that. Pretty powerful, huh? All right, it's March the 30th. I'd like you to go back. Remember, there's no time. 1852. Anna van Gogh in Holland gives birth, Anna Cornelia van Gogh, gives birth to a little boy, March the 30th, 1852. He's stillborn. His name is Vincent. And she names him Vincent van Gogh and buries him. March the 30th, 1853, 1 year to the day, she gives birth to her second son and names him Vincent. And he grows up to believe that he's a replacement child, when in fact, as Sylvia told me, Sylvia Brown, he was same being again a year later. I don't think he listened to psychics in those days. So this young man is tormented He's incredibly talented, never sells a painting in his life, but he loves the sunshine. And he paints and paints and paints the potato eaters and some of these great paintings. And his last painting is called Starry Night. And after he paints Starry Night, on the 27th of July, 1890, the age of 37, he goes out to a field with a revolver in his hand, after having cut off part of his ear, and his best friend, another famous artist named Gauguin, had saved him that time. And he took a revolver and he shot himself in the chest. And Gauguin found him and dragged him back to his brother's home. And for two agonizing days, he bled to death and died on the 29th of July in 1890, never having sold a painting. Don McLean, a great songwriter, "Bye, bye, Miss American Pie, drove my Chevy to the levee, levee was dry." You have to listen to the words to that and look at all the meaning that's in that. Don McLean reads the story of Starry Night and Vincent van Gogh and decides to write a song. I close with this because it's about finding inspiration anywhere. A book, a story, a song, a poem. The poetry book that I'm writing is called Without You, There Is No Poetry. With You, There's Nothing Else. And it's about connecting to God and someone you love very dearly. And Don McLean went back to his home and he sat down and he wrote these words out to a song called Starry, Starry Night as a dedication to this man whose life, he even says in there, this world was never made for one as beautiful as you. If you read his story, you'll see exactly what I mean. And I asked Skye, when she did her CD, You Inspire Me, her new one, she wrote every song in there except for the one I asked if she would please write it. I'll get permission and pay the permissions if you'll include this song, this inspirational turn. And after the song was written, it was played at the Van Gogh Museum in Amsterdam for the entire decade of the 70s and buried in a time capsule with his paintbrushes to be opened in 1,000 years. And this is the tribute, how you can find inspiration as a simple man writing a song about such a great, great human being. Ladies and gentlemen, my beautiful daughter Skye, to close it out with Starry, Starry Night.
Starry, starry night, paint your palette blue and gray. Look out on a summer's day with eyes and know the darkness in my soul. Shadows on the hill, sketch the trees and the daffodil. Catch the breeze and the winter chill in colors on the snowy linen land. Now I understand what you tried to say to me, how you suffered for your sanity, how you tried to set them free. They would not listen, they did not know how. Perhaps they'll listen now. Starry, starry night, flaming flowers that brightly blaze, swirling clouds and violet haze reflect in Vincent's eyes of china blue. Colors changing hue, morning fields of amber grain. Weathered faces lined in pain are soothed beneath the artist's loving hand. Now I understand what you tried to say to me, how you suffered for your sanity, how you tried to set them free. They would not listen, they did not know how. Perhaps they'll listen now. For they could not love you, but still your love was true. And when no hope was left inside on that starry, starry night, you took your life as lovers often do. But I could have told you, Vincent, this world was never meant for one as beautiful as you. Starry, starry night, portraits hung in empty halls, frameless heads on nameless walls, with eyes that watch the world and can't forget, like the stranger that you've met, the ragged man in ragged clothes, the silver thorn of bloody rose, like crushed and broken on the virgin snow. Now I think I know what you tried to say to me, how you suffered for your sanity, and how you tried to set them free. They would not listen there, not listening still. Perhaps they never will. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you, Sky. They were not listening. They're not listening still. Perhaps they never will. In the Enneagram, the final page of the Enneagram, the wisdom of the Enneagram, it says these words: if we were to awaken to the moment, we would experience reality. If we were to experience reality, we would see that we are not our personality. If we were to see that we are not our personality, we would remember ourselves. If we were to remember ourselves, we would let go of our fears and our attachments. If we were to let go of our fears and our attachments, we would be touched by God. If we were touched by God, we would seek union with God. If we were to seek union with God, we would will what God wills. If we were to will what God wills, we would be transformed. If we were transformed, the whole world would be transformed. If the whole world were transformed, we would all return to God. That's your challenge. You can either be a host to God or a hostage to your ego. Thanks for coming, and God bless you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you so much. Namaste.